Peter Izard, Reel 4.
Yes, the organization on the ground was quite something. I mean, the Americans had brought all sorts of things across the Atlantic. Fortunately, they had, in the terms of the occupation of Germany, they had in fact asked for a port to the north, and they were using Bremerhaven. So a lot of stuff came in that way. The stuff from Denmark, obviously, the dairy produce came down through, especially Holstein, and into Hamburg. The major concern was coal. I mean, the whole of the winter of 48-49, the average person was allowed 200 weight of coal for the whole winter. Electricity, which again relied on coal for the power stations, that only came on as it was supplied, would you believe, from the Russian sector of Berlin. That came on only in a couple of hours a day. So you had to leave a light on, switched on, so that if you had a light, because don't forget, a lot of people were living in halls and basements and a room like this with just a tarpaulin across one side and things like that. So they had to leave something so that when the light came on, they could do some ironing or whatever. They grew, there are photographs of huge vegetable patches around the Brandenburg Gate. They went out and they got special permission, because the Germans love their trees, to cut down a certain quota of trees for heating and things like that. There were still incidents in Berlin between the Russians and the others, and it was still going on. But everything was finally organised, and of course in Berlin particularly, the services, both American, French and British, used a lot of their personal rations for the children at Christmas, the Christmas of 48-49. And Gail Halvorsen, who was a pilot of the Americans and retired as a colonel, who I've been my pleasure to know for a number of years, he was the one who was known as Uncle Waggle Wings, who he had a layover in Berlin, and he went to the edge of the airfield one day, and there were a number of children there watching the aeroplanes, and he had some candy in his pocket, and he gave it to one of the children, who didn't share it, who ate it, and the other children watched, and they didn't try and take it away from him. And he said to them, one of them spoke English, and he said, "Why don't you, why didn't everybody jump on you?" And they said, "Because we have freedom of choice as a child." So he said, right, and he started a movement, actually. They used to come in and, using handkerchiefs, they used to drop Hershey bars and things out of the aircraft to the children on the ground. And Gail Halvorsen, one of the girls, wrote to him later in life and said that, she'd been the girl who wrote to us. She wrote to him and said, "Dear Uncle Waggle Wings," whatever it was, "I keep missing out on the chocolate." So he made sure that he had some time, and he went to see her with her parents in Berlin. And she is now a very firm family friend. She goes over to the States and stays with Gail. A lot of people, incredible, when we've been back to Berlin, people come up and shake your hand. When we marched through Berlin 2 years ago, the streets were lined with people cheering and clapping. It was quite something. But the coal, as I say, was important, because during the in the 10 days, or 10 days to a fortnight in 1945, when it took 10 days, 2 weeks for the Brits, for instance, to get into their area of Berlin. And came up against lots of problems with the Russians. The Russians took everything, including the new Berlin West power station, which had been finished just before the war. So in fact, during the Berlin airlift, the combined forces of America and Britain flew in a power station. Not a very big one, but they flew one in and put it into operation. decided after this to go back to BOAC, thinking we could now move mountains, and we weren't doing it. And I don't think they even do it today, quite honestly. Not the way we did it. And it really was quite something.
Well, what would be problems with some of these loads you've mentioned? You know, one thinks of flour and sugar and coal and dust, and whether that was a problem.
The dust from the coal was quite awful. I mean, if you go and look at the... they've got 12 Dakotas up at Atlantic Airways at Coventry Airport. They're still finding coal. The Hastings aircraft, which is at Cosford, they're still finding coal there. In fact, it was a very great danger because the coal dust, in certain circumstances, of course, can be compressed and explode. So they actually flew, some of the aircraft actually flew with the escape windows removed. So, I mean, they didn't fly that high, you know, it was a bit cold. But in order that this stuff would not cause a problem from that point of view, on the coal runs into Berlin, when the coal was emptied from the aircraft, when the aircraft was actually empty, two or three women would get into the aeroplane with brooms and start to sweep up the coal dust on the floor whilst the aircraft was taxiing back to take off. And when they got to the end of the runway to take off, the women and their little bags of coal dust got off the aeroplane. And in fact, I think I'm right in saying that they... In that way, they reclaimed something like 50 aircraft loads of coal during the whole course of the air lift. Another thing that happened where they were having problems with the runway, they had groups of workers who were standing by the runway under supervision. And as an aircraft landed, they rushed out on the runway and filled in the holes. And as the next aircraft came, they rushed back again. Of course, at one point, it was decided that they needed a third airfield, which is now the international airport of Berlin, Tegel. And that was built in 98 days, mostly using the rubble from bombed-out buildings and such like. At the end of that time, there was only one problem, that in the British sector, in the French sector, there was a very large radio mast, which was used by the Russians. And it just happened to be in the French sector. And it really was a navigational hazard to the aircraft. And whilst the French didn't do very much flying, in fact, they did virtually none, because they didn't have any aircraft and they were having problems in Indochina, which was where most of their aircraft were, the commander of the garrison there invited his opposite numbers from the Americans and the British to his headquarters, which was near this radio mast one morning for champagne cocktails. And they all wondered what the hell was going on. While they were there, he then blew out the radio mast. And the Russians got very cross and said, "This is unethical." And then, yeah, and everybody said, "Excuse me." But so that was one of their major contributions. But the other loads, they tried, as far as the coal, well, the coal and the flour, they tried dropping it, which they thought might, you know, save the aircraft landing and all this, that and the other. Bearing in mind that the aircraft which were being used, the Yorks, and from the American point of view, the DC-4 Skymaster, they were built for long distance flying. You know, they weren't supposed to. You know, you get in the air and for 8 hours your engines run at a constant speed, but here, every sort of 50 minutes or so, it would all land and take off and wear and tear on the tyres. So they decided to try and drop it, of course, and it was a hopeless failure. The observers on the ground just got covered with coal dust because the thing just, as it impacted, it all went to dust. As far as the flour was concerned, they did an exercise to find out whether it was better to fly in bread already baked or bake it in Berlin. And it was decided the weight only distribution, because of the water content of the bread when it was cooked, precluded us flying it in as loads. So it was flown in as flour. But that also was tested and dropping it, and that didn't work either. But all the other loads were pretty straightforward. The requirement for the people supplying it was that it should be packed so that it could be put into an aeroplane. I mean, these days you put in a container and the container would be shipped in the aeroplane. But, you know, we were fielding hundredweight, 112 pounds, sacks of flour. Coal was, how much they put in a coal sack, but I guess that was probably 100 weight as well. And they did very well. I think they were unloading an aircraft full of coal in the end in something like 9 minutes. It was quite incredible, really. But the dehydrated potatoes and pea meat and all those things, they all came in convenient boxes. They weren't necessarily convenient, excuse me, from our point of view, because in some cases we could have done them being bigger. You know, I mean, you get a box that, you know, sort of 1 foot square, 1 foot cube, you then got to, you can't really lash it with a rope, you've got it with a net. And, in the beginning they were not that easy to come by because we didn't have them. I mean, our aircraft were, you know, sort of half the aircraft was freight and baggage and the other half was passengers and we were taking them long distance. So we needed the nets which had to go down and be spun over the load, whatever it was, and we also had to make sure that the loads were in the right place. We actually, one of the first jobs we did when we got there was to do a specimen load sheet for each aircraft because all aeroplanes are different in the way they fly and their actual final weight. It might only be 20 pounds difference or such like, but they are different. And so we did a straightforward load sheet for each aircraft and stuck it up on a bulkhead inside the aeroplane so that anybody loading that aeroplane could make sure it was in the right compartment. The compartment, I mean, they don't exist, the compartments, they're just yellow lines on the wall. But eventually it was all absolutely, you know, straightforward, like anything else. I mean, from my point of view, from life after the airlift, the most significant thing that happened was that air traffic control, as we know it today, started with the Berlin airlift, because it had to start that way. Ground control approach with radar and people being talked down and such like, all that really started there. It was already in its infancy in the American Air Force and the IAF, but in full scale operation, that's where it started. You know, stacking aircraft here and there and doing things. It was was the point at which it started. I wasn't there at the end of the airlift. I'd already been sent home and demobilised, and I didn't really want to go back to BOAC because I went back and had a look at all the chaps who'd been demobilised at the end of 1945. Who got my job, so to speak. So I went looking for something else, and I went to work as a travelling traffic officer with Westminster Airways, another one of these small outfits, and when I actually worked for them for 12 hours, and they were requisitioned to go on the Berlin airlift. So I lost, and I went back to BOAC.
Yes, keep going back to the airlift, you know, and all this, these materials which were coming into people who were pretty desperate, really, yes. Even in your, you know, West Berlin, yes. West Germany, rather, yes. Not Berlin. Did you suffer any pilfering or stealing?
Yes, it did happen. It did happen. What basically happened to the people who were caught was that they lost their job, which in the circumstances that appertained at the time was pretty drastic. They were doing quite well, considering. I mean, when you consider that they were a completely defeated nation and that they had suffered very greatly under the Russians between 45 and 48. You know, I suppose most of the most of the women in Berlin had been raped.
Was that so, or was it, you know, just rumour? No, no.
It happened. It happened a lot. It's statistics quoted, but if you you may get to read it yourself, this book by Leon Uro, Armageddon, it's a novel, but it's based on fact. Everything that's in that book actually happened. They terrorised the Western population of Berlin. What they wanted them to do was to vote communist in the local elections, and if it hadn't been for Reuter, the mayor and his lady, I can't think of her name offhand, it would have happened. They used all sorts of ruses, and they kidnapped people, they beat people up, people were murdered, people disappeared. There were incidents between the official forces, between the American colonels and generals and the Russian colonels and generals, and all sorts of things that they came in and occupied the American offices one morning. And, it was a great.
Did you meet any yourself, the Russian?
No, I've met them since. They say the Berlin blockade. I don't know anything about that. I mean, Russian history is. There was the Great Patriotic War, which was fought between the Germans and the Russians. They never acknowledged the fact of all the help they got from us and the Americans and things like that. They didn't want to know, because there, if you look at even today, the badge of the Soviet forces is a globe surmounted by a star. World domination. I wouldn't trust them any further than I could throw them today, especially this man Putin.
How about, going back to the sort of airlift time,
yes.
Was there ever any fear that this could escalate, into war?
Yes.
You know, was there precautions taken?
Well, I have two colleagues, Jeff Smith, who was an electrician in Berlin, and John Collier, who was in the Royal Air Force Regiment. They were convinced that one morning they would wake up and find a Russian soldier standing at the bottom of the bed. And they did, in fact, have to, the regiment actually and the army actually chase the Russians out. They used to make holes in the wire and come through onto the airfield at Gatow, because the border run the road on the edge of the airfield. And, they could have, if they wanted to. I think the whole point about it was that Stalin didn't want another war. But he thought he could, because what he wanted to do was to completely colonize Germany. And if he'd done that, he would have, I don't know if you've read any of the French domestic history about the Communist Party in France. But the first thing that they did when they went into France at the end of the war was to arrest all the members of the communist resistance, because they were big and they were organised, ready to take over the country. And if Germany and France had been communist, there wouldn't be much hope for the rest of Europe, really. And then it would have just been a question of build up until they were ready to do it. They had lots of. Flying in a civil Halton one afternoon going to Berlin, and we were buzzed by a Soviet fighter. To get away from it, in the end, the captain, I was sitting in the jump seat by the captain, and we actually did a barrel roll in this large aeroplane. And when we finished and we came out and leveled up on course again, this Russian aircraft came and sat over the starboard wing, and the bloke actually put the cockpit and thumbed his nose at me. They did all sorts of things. They shone searchlights in people's eyes at night, and they carried out anti-aircraft tests on either side of the corridors. It really was quite stress-making, I suppose, in modern parlance. What they didn't realise, I think, was had it really come to push come to shove, I think the boys would have said, well, and you, bang. But of course, we did have the one before that Berlin had started, the collision between a Russian fighter and a British European Airways Viscount, Viking, where everybody was killed. And they wouldn't even let the Brits go and look at the wreckage and to decide what actually happened. And they said it was the Brits' fault, not anybody else's. You know. After the war, I went to the lecture that was gave by a Russian air attaché from the embassy. And what he told us about the history of aviation, you know, and wasn't the right part of the T-30, it was the Russian and all this business. I mean, they really, you know, they were worse than the Nazis. And I've got a book upstairs, I'm just reading on the Stalinist terror. I mean, the number of people that the Nazis killed is pales into insignificance. And what Stalin did to his own people.
Yes, going back to the loads that you were taking. You mentioned earlier that there were returning loads eventually. Yes. Could you tell me more about these? What was coming out of Berlin?
Well, as I say, it was thought that from a propaganda point of view that the Berlin Symphony Orchestra playing in Western countries would be a good thing, so they were flown out. I know it once or twice. It was decided by the various medical commissions that quite a number of the children were undernourished and in danger of all sorts of things, rickets and God knows what. And so they were flown out for holidays, and some of them came out permanently with their parents. And of course there was, as I said, those light engineering manufacturing things. Now, I can't tell you exactly what they were, because quite honestly, I don't know. But I would imagine such things as garden shears and, you know, minor items, but there was the desire to have what was left of the male population in employment. Most of the, in Berlin, most of the women were what they called Trommelfrau, who were working in the ruins, trimming bricks, and loading them, and they were going away to build the ruins and all this, that, and the other, and they got an extra ration and such like for that. But there were a number of manufacturing companies who managed to get back into business and were greatly encouraged. A lot of the raw materials were taken in, but I have no idea what they were, because I've not read a book that actually says what they were.
They didn't come into your
Wunstorf.
No, but these other people did they? The evacuees and the.
Yes, some of those came to us.
Yes.
It depended basically on where they were going within Germany or within Europe. In some cases, of course, there were areas within Western Europe where you wouldn't dare send a German child. Some of the places in France where they raised a village to the ground and all that sort of thing. And a lot of people were still very anti. I mean, you read it today. So my friend in Germany, my friends, their grandfathers probably were in the SS or something like that, but they're not. You've got to take that into account. The whole thing about it, I think I don't believe while we were there that we really realised just exactly how important the thing was. I mean, it really was the first battle of the Cold War. And fortunately, we won it. But it was a big humanitarian effort. I mean, it had never been known before in history that a country that had been so awful and which had caused so much suffering would suddenly be succoured by its enemies.
Yes. Do you think it made a difference to Anglo-German relations, you know, from the Germans you yourself have met.
Oh yes, absolutely. I think indeed when we go over now, it's quite amazing the Berlin Area of Gratitude Foundation, which said, you know, we need you to come over for the 50th anniversary. The Americans have got an association, you haven't. So we started one, which was about 7 years ago. And they've spent over, 5 million francs, marks? A lot of money. We took 500 over on the 50th anniversary. They paid for all the airfares, all the hotel accommodation, all the hospitality, all the entertainment, the whole bit. You know. And it doesn't matter where you go, certainly in Berlin, people know, and the youngsters know about it. I did a lecture, was about 7 months ago, I think, at the German school in Richmond, for their sixth and seventh form, or 17, 18 year olds. They were absolutely fascinated by the whole thing. And several of them came up and said, you know, you saved my mother's life. And lots of people who were born about that time, you know, young babies being born, you know. And of course, apart from that, there was this terrible trauma of displaced persons.
Yes, it was interesting you saying that.
Quite awful, really. I mean, I came up against this really afterwards when I was in the reserve going over to RAF Lahrbruck in Germany, where between us and the Ruhr there was this very upset to somebody went over there and I said, what's that place, you know, where you play the Italian and such. And all that's a displaced persons camp. And they're all prefabs like we have in this country. And they put these people in there, and a lot of them just stayed there. They never went home. When they saw what was going on in Poland and Czechoslovakia and with the Russians and the communists, they didn't want to go anyway. And a lot of them went back and put in prison. So that was, as I say, there's some of them, I'm very old now, some of them are still there. And I believe some of their families are still there.
How about your own living accommodation and lifestyle while you were in Germany?
Well, that eventually was very nice because and I've been back to see it since. The old Luftwaffe airmen's or soldiers' accommodation were in three-story barrack blocks. Very well done. With basically a main entrance in the centre and two rooms on either side with the usual toilets and bathrooms and such like, and then the same on the next floor. And then there was an attic. You know, they were quite big buildings with louver windows and dormer windows rather not. And we managed to get ourselves into one of these attics, and it was idyllic because every airport over there has got pine forest, you know. So we were up there, and the windows open, and, you know, several of us had been in the Hanover and got cuckoo clocks, and they were hanging up, and, you know. But it was one of those situations, the sort of situation that I always preferred to be in, where you work, you know. And when you finish work, you go and enjoy yourself, and then you go to bed. But when you're working, you know, the time goes, and you know. But the food was good. There was nothing I recall about the living conditions that was bad. We had Steinhudemir not very far away, and we could stroll down there. And when we were off duty, if we had the time, walk along the lake.